this lecture or preparations for this lecture, I also used as an opportunity to develop some thoughts I had for some time. So this was a nice way for me to focus and kind of put them on paper. So I'm also curious to hear reactions or thoughts, or because it's kind of just the beginning, I think, of some thinking on this topic. I hope you all got this handout, which is a translation of subtitles in the first video, because it's a documentation made, I would say, by Italian TV, because the subtitles are in Italian. So I didn't manage to make double subtitles in the video, and this is a solution so that you can follow. I would like to open this lecture with two recent news from the field of contemporary art. The first one comes from Georgia, dated October the 2nd, 2012, and entitled "Billionaire Art Collector Said to Be Next Georgian Prime Minister." The news reads as follows. The political coalition party led by Bidzina Ivanishvili, the billionaire businessman and art collector, has won the Georgian parliamentary election. The country's president, Mikhail Saakashvili, conceded defeat today, saying that the opposition Georgian Dream coalition had won the country's parliamentary election. Ivanishvili is expected to be nominated to become the new prime minister, the first to be democratically elected to the post. Previously highly secretive, Ivanishvili made his fortune in Russia in banking and mining. He announced last year that, as well as entering the political arena, he plans to build a Guggenheim-style museum in Tbilisi. It will have an acquisition budget of $100 million. He told the website Eurasianet.org he owns work by Anish Kapoor and Henry Moore, Egon Schiele and Monet, and in 2006 purchased Picasso's Dora Maar Osha, 1941, for $95.2 million, and Sotheby's New York. Accompanying the short news, we see a serious portrait of Mr. Ivanishvili in front of Damien Hirst's spot painting, as well as in a more jovial pose, you could say, in front of Roy Lichtenstein's interior with red wall. At the same time, the news also came from the neighboring Azerbaijan in the article entitled "Azerbaijan to Get Contemporary Art Space and Maybe a Biennial." We read the following. Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, will get a display space for international and local contemporary art within 2 years and could host a visual arts biennale within three. Aida Mahmudova, 30, an arts patron who is the niece of the First Lady, is currently assembling a collection for the Yarat Foundation, an artist collective she set up a year ago, and has purchased works by the British artist Idris Khan and the Iranian Farhad Moshiri, among others. The Yarat Foundation currently has a small space, but Mahmudova says she's looking for a more suitable building with approximately 1,200 square meter for this place in which to show the works. The new gallery will also host exhibitions of paintings, sculptures, and videos by Azeri artists. While the contemporary art scene in the post-Soviet state is still in its infancy, Mahmudova, who is herself a practicing artist and studied at Central St. Martin's in London, says she is trying to encourage others to support local artists. Most of the collectors here buy post-war art. Contemporary art is still new. We are trying to set a trend to collect people who are younger and have a future ahead of them, she says. Launching a contemporary art biennale would galvanize the scene and help put Baku on the international art world map, says Mahmudova. It's a big plan for the future, a very important one, so we are currently working out our strategy, she says. Yarat's other initiatives include an arts festival in Baku earlier this year, a display of Azeri contemporary art at the Moscow Biennale, and an exhibition of lots from forthcoming sales at Christie's, co-organized with the auction house last month. First of all, we should not make a mistake here to ridicule the desire of those two political figures to bring to their respected countries the elements of life that are today considered civilized, or should we say civilizing. Museums as institutions had already served an important role in supporting the creation of the nation states worldwide. Nevertheless, what we see here is the next step, the introduction of contemporary art to this region, diagnosed by both persons as lacking or, as stated in one of the news, in its infancy. I guess a good news for anyone declaring themselves as contemporary artists, as there seems to be more opportunities coming soon their way. On the other hand, these news items do not try to hide the connection between current market of contemporary art and wealth accumulation. As we already know from Guy Debord, the spectacle is capital to such a degree of accumulation that it becomes an image. The spectacle is not a collection of images, but a social relation among people mediated by images. In other words, what would the wealth be without spectacle, without display? This fact also brings to mind a parallel to some previous connections between the wealthy ones and building of the churches as a way to clear one's consciousness. As it seems, in order to take a place in the global game of wealth and display, these cities and politics need museums of contemporary art. Otherwise, they do not stand a chance to be considered progressive. According to several authors, the 1990s in Europe were significant not only on a political level, but had marked a new moment in the development of artistic and curatorial practices as well. A new kind of curator suddenly had to become an expert not only on history of art, but on local cultures as well. Or in the words of Francesco Bonami, the role of the curator today involves such enormous geographical diversity that the curator is now a kind of visual anthropologist, no longer just a tastemaker, but a cultural analyst. In the moment of recanonization of Western artistic practices, new tools for understanding art from all over the world were needed. Curiously enough, they were found in anthropology. Nevertheless, these two disciplines has responded to the post-1989 shifts in highly different ways. As Thomas Boutou notices, quote, whereas anthropology plunged into years of epistemological crisis and anxious introspection, contemporary art can be said to have inaugurated an unprecedented era of vitality and expansion. Throughout the 90s, the anthropological world found itself in a quandary when asked to explain how it contributed to the understanding of the world in which we live. During the same period, the contemporary art world enthusiastically embraced the global, taking this new phenomenon as an opportunity to reinvent itself. Rather than being shaken like anthropologists by the size and power of the emergent global circulation, the art world's protagonists were impressed by the pervasive raggedness of this new world, focusing on global coherence and using it as leverage to integrate sites of artistic production previously considered marginal to Western modernism. Pardon. We will look now in a more detailed way. How did the field of contemporary art take over the questionable anthropological categories and methodology and at the same time distorted them? The official art history takes as a turning point of this shift the exhibition Magicien de la Terre that took place at the Pompidou Center in Paris in 1989. The exhibition was conceived already in 1985 by Jean-Hubert Martin, a newly appointed director of the Paris Biennale. Quote, originally intended as a replacement for the Biennale's traditional format, in which contributors were selected by cultural representatives and committees from each participating country, This show has now grown into a major exhibition of international contemporary art. Its organizers intend to explore the practices of artists in Asian, African, and Latin American countries, juxtaposing a selection of work from those cultural contexts with contemporary works from the United States and Western Europe. End of quote. I would suggest here that we first take a look at the short and rare video document from the preparation of this exhibition. We will proceed with the analysis of this segment and juxtapose it to the curatorial explanations given by its chief curator, Jean-Aubert Martin, in an interview by Benjamin Buchlock. This is where you will need the translation.
Thank you.
Well, as we have seen, this short segment opens with images of the artists under the title UN Duma Australia, hence what one could consider it to be the name of this group, community or a tribe. Nevertheless, it's a name of a town that ranks as one of the larger remote communities in Central Australia and was established by the Australian government after World War II. Here we find it used as a naming tool for this group of artists belonging to either Valpiri or Unmeter people, we are not sure. We find them working on a large painting on the ground, but we do not understand the words they are saying. We see their faces, noses, hands, they talk between each other, but we are not given a translation or insight into their talk. Nevertheless, what is translated is the explanation of their artwork. It represents the dreaming of rain. You can see the rain that falls and the clouds are next to it. The following part offers us no name for the artist's film next. We see a Chinese guy washing newspapers in a washing machine and making a wall installation from it. We hear from him that his main inspiration is Taoist philosophy, which refuses to seek for answers, that he has a problem to define his relationship with the Chinese culture, although he is supposed to represent China at this exhibition, and that he finds this show very important as it allows him to compare himself to other Western artists, hence discover new things about his work. And as a little footnote, his name is actually Huan Yongping, and we can find the following information on his Wikipedia page. In 1989, at the age of 35, Huan Yongping went to Paris for the Magicians of Earth exhibit. He then ended up immigrating to France and living there ever since. The third part introduces a group of Tibetan monks working on a sand mandala. We see the hard work they're investing in this almost impossible task of creating a complex image using only dust and metal sticks. We hear the sound of scrubbing, we see the drops of sweat on their foreheads, but we are given no names and hear no voice from them. The last part of the video states the name of the artist. We see Joe Ben Jr., a Navajo American Indian. But before we see him, we witness a short talk between his wife and an African woman wearing traditional clothes. On first woman's comment that her blanket looks just like the American Indian's one, African woman asks, "In India?" And hears, no, United States Indian. We hear her aha as a polite expression of understanding something that does not seem logical. Further on, we see a couple with a little daughter working in the sand. The father is the artist, and we see him putting different pigments working on the sand painting. His daughter participates as well. She shows her little painting to her mom and erases it in the next moment by burying it with sand. A little gesture of destruction as a prerequisite for the possibility of a new creation, we could say. What can be fruitful for our discussion at this point is to try to understand how is the notion of contemporary art defined here. We see collectives, in some cases families of artists from Australia, Tibet and the USA, as the representatives of what we could call traditional artistic practices. The only individual here that seems to correspond the closest to the canon of what we name modern art is the nameless Chinese artist. Even in his explanation, he states that his motivation to participate here was in confronting his own practice with the Western artists. In the case of the representatives of traditional art, they seem as if they were abruptly taken out of their original context and placed in the proclaimed neutral space of a white cube, a sort of a democratic platform where different artistic practices will be compared to each other. Although a small fragment and almost an accidental testimony of this exhibition, the video does not give us any information about the other Western artists participating here. What becomes obvious, nevertheless, is that contemporary art is understood in its most literal meaning. as an activity of producing art in the present contemporary moment. Pardon. According to the curator, Jean-Hubert Mertin, his intention was to treat contemporary art production on a global, worldwide scale. And the way to do this, nevertheless, according to him, is through the eyes of Eurocentrism. Quote, since we are dealing with objects of visual and sensual experience, let's really look at them from the perspective of our own culture. I want to play the role of someone who uses artistic intuition alone to select these objects which come from totally different cultures. I intend to select these objects from various cultures according to my own history and my own sensibility. End of quote. Although approaching the same territories and cultures, Martin distinguishes his method from the ethnographic one. Quote, if, for example, an ethnographer suggests to us a particular example of a cult in a society in the Pacific, but it turns out that the objects of this culture do not communicate sufficiently well in a visual, sensual manner to Western spectator, then I would refrain from exhibiting them. I cannot select objects in the manner of ethnographers who choose them according to their importance and function inside the culture, even though such objects may mean or communicate very little or nothing at all to us. On Buchloch's question, what are his criteria for the strength of a work, Martin replies, the intensity of communication of meaning. Meaning for us or meaning for them? For us, obviously. That's important because whatever meaning a practice has for its practitioners is not relevant to us if it cannot be communicated to us. End of quote. As his main idea was to create a dialogue with other cultures, we can assume that Martin believes this was the way to do it. Not trying to understand elements of other cultures, but focusing only on the items that we might consider visually attractive, hence valuable. Or as he had formulated his answer to the possible neocolonial subtext of this exhibition, I oppose the idea that one can only look at another culture in order to exploit it. Our first concern is with exchange and dialogue, with understanding others in order to understand what we do ourselves. One cannot say that we still live in a neocolonialist period. Obviously, the Western world maintains dominant relationships with respect to the third world. But that should not prohibit us from communicating with the people of these nations, nor from looking at their cultural practices. End of quote. And that is achieved, one might conclude, by looking at them from our own perspective, favoring our own cultural framework in relation to theirs, offering them to participate in a dialogue with previously set rules and communicators. Nevertheless, the reason for this exhibition, as we read further, is in order to gain primacy in taking a discourse of Western art into a new direction. Quote, what is especially important to recognize is that this will be the first truly international exhibition of worldwide contemporary art. The objects in our exhibition will be displaced from their functional context, and they will be shown in a museum and another exhibition space in Paris. But we will display them in a manner that has never been used for objects from the third world. That is, for the most part, the makers of these objects will be present, and I will avoid showing finished, movable objects as much as possible. Hence, a newness promoted through this exhibition was to exhibit not only objects, but artists as well, a fact to which we will come back later. Just like the Chinese artist has articulated in the video, one of the effects of this exhibition was to juxtapose, to compare all those different works belonging to different contexts and traditions to one source, that of Western art. We are not to expect a multilateral comparison between different cultures, a method in which Western art would become one among many, but it will serve as a parameter to which all others will be compared to. One of the most contradictory statements given by the curator relates to the question of the effect of Western invasion on other peoples and cultures, in which we also hear about the Australian Aborigines' reason to participate in the first place. I'm really against the assumption that we have in fact destroyed all other cultures with Western technology. A text written by the Aboriginal artists of Australia who are participating in this exhibition has clarified this issue for me. They state the problem of decontextualization perfectly well, but they go on to argue that they committed their treason for a particular purpose, to prove to the white world that their society is still alive and functioning. Exhibiting their cultural practices to the West is what they believe to be the best way to protect their traditions and their culture at this point of time. End of quote. Hence, the Aboriginal participation can be seen as part of their protest, as part of their resistance of the destruction brought by the white people. In an interesting twist of arguments, their desire to communicate that they still exist, not because of the mercy of the whites, but thanks to their fight and resistance, has been turned into a proof that we have been forgiven for the crimes. Let us now try to go back to the 90s. When you think about the artistic production and the exhibitions of that time, the word that defines this period, the concept that inevitably comes to mind, is identity. In those times of various shifts and global invasion of liberal capitalism, popularly named globalism, the definition of clear ethnic identities in art and politics had become one of the most important traits of human beings to be worked upon. As we have seen, the field of contemporary art had become one of the main collaborators in this project. And suddenly the key to understand different artistic practices was found in the domain of culture and cultural identities, more often in the origin of the artists than in the art schools they might have attended. As it seems, we are to believe today that all this has been resolved. At least, try to think about when was the last time you have heard the word identity in the arts. What is important to repeat at this point is that at the very same time, the anthropological theory had officially reached its crisis. This happened after the discovery that its approach, its methodology, mainly exoticized the others it was researching about, being used as an extended hand of colonialism and having devastating consequences on the political level for those others. As it seems, the art world did not have any problem with taking over the production and reproduction of the images of all those strange others, turning them into main product on the art market. The avatar body of the dark side of anthropology has found its new materialization using this opportunity for the production of a new spectacle. In previous decades, there has been much discussion about the problematic Western definition of stable, fixed identities, as well as the role of the other in this. This short summary, thanks to Stuart Hall, is as follows. 1. The first school is the one of the linguist Ferdinand de Saussure, who had concluded that difference matters because it is essential to meaning. All meaning is relational, and without it, it would not exist. Our language and culture operate in binary oppositions. Nevertheless, from his side, the philosopher Jacques Derrida adds to this that there are just a few neutral binary oppositions. One pole of the binary is usually the dominant one, the one which includes the other within its field of operations. 2. Mikhail Bakhtin sees his school sees the need for difference because we can only construct meaning through a dialogue with the other. For him, meaning does not belong to any one speaker, which allows us to enter into a struggle over meaning. 3. The anthropological explanation states that the culture depends on giving things meaning by assigning them to different positions within a classificatory system. The marking of difference is the very basis of the symbolic order we call culture. Therefore, what unsettles culture is matter out of place. The psychoanalysis, that's 4, sees the other as fundamental to the construction of the self, to us as subjects and to the sexual identity. Lacan goes even further and states that we are never fully unified as subjects. We are formed in relation to something which completes us, but which, since it lies outside us, we in some way always lack. And it is on this lack that the collections of objects seem to be created upon as well. Like a serial killer, the collector's desire is never satisfied. The collections are never complete, and this frightening split in our identities needs new victims. We capture and collect, from butterflies to people, believing that by capturing their beauty, by possessing them, we will feel valuable in return. What we fail to see is that once placed under the glass, our prey is already dead. The strong and productive connection between museum culture and early anthropology has been already formulated, and one of the explanations for this has been offered by Roy Wagner. Quote, "For museums form the logical point of transition or articulation between the two major senses of culture. They metaphorize ethnographic specimens and data by analyzing and preserving them, making them necessary to our own refinement, although they belong to some other culture. The study of primitives had become a function of our invention of the past." End of quote. Besides, as Walter Benjamin had reminded us in his thinking about cultural treasures, there is no document of civilization which is not at the same time a document of barbarism. One of the sad stories we are always reminded when discussing the relationship between anthropology and museological practice is the story about Ishi, who was the last surviving member of his American Indian tribe Yaha after the years of massacre by Europeans searching for gold. He was saved from prison by one of the founding fathers of American anthropology, Alfred Louis Kreber, and has spent last years of his life living in a museum. I would suggest here that we take a look into a short insert of a TV movie about Ishi's life.
Farmers, is he? Farmers. Can you make anything? Bows? Arrows? I mean, would you want to?
Yes. That would be a good thing. We can find a place for me, and I can show your people how to make such things. In the years to come, the museum will have more than just words.
fasting. But how does it come to be here? We've got a cell that she wove into. This is the furnace thing. It came from Round Meadow. This is the iris, the little one that I found across the creek, high up. Ah, the smell of the cave. Woven Nupo was in there. Even the little one is now part of the Sabdu world.
There are many things that I've built and done, but there was only so much that I can teach you in the museum.
Video from YouTube, so the quality is not the best, but that was the only way to find it. So a tragedy of one of the American tribes, as we have seen, translated into a comforting story that at least there was a museum in which Ishii could spend his last years in an almost natural environment, sharing his skills and knowledge with the visitors. As Wagner notices, quote, museums had by then assumed fully the role of a reservation for Indian culture, and we are told that in good weather, Kreber and others would take Ishii back into the hills so that he could demonstrate Yahi techniques and bushcraft. But this again is precisely the point. By accepting employment as a museum specimen, Ishii accomplished the metaphorization of life into culture that defines much of anthropological understanding, end of quote. Hence, what we have witnessed with anthropological museology is, according to Wagner, a process of metaphorization of life into culture. In comparison to this, what happens when all this is taken over by contemporary art? Perhaps we here witness a reverse movement, a metaphorization of culture into life, replacements of the one for the other. If so, what kind of life is supported and promoted within its white walls? According to Gerardo Mosquera, contemporary art as a discourse is strongly defined by its Eurocentrism, while we could consider contemporary artistic scene to be, quote, a very centralized system of apartheid. If we go back to the first video we have seen, one of the important aspects of these exotic artistic practices is their ephemeral nature. If you have noticed, their material is mostly sand or dust used in different ways. After the show is over, there is nothing left behind to be sold at the market. Nevertheless, by fixating the identities in the art world, this new collection of exotic cabinet wonders testifies not only about the ongoing project of erasing everything different from the Western traditions, by giving them place in the museum, things are already seen as if on their deathbed. It also testifies about the fact that since there is nothing there we could turn into product and sell on the art market, the only thing left to be turned into currency and traded are their identities. According to the curator of the Magicien, contemporary way of exhibiting will not mean exhibiting material objects only, but their creators as well. Artistic, shamanistic, human creativity has been displaced, taken out of its context, reduced to its aesthetic level, giving the illusion that we now understand it, that we comprehend what happens there, that we are now in possession of knowledge. Nevertheless, what we actually have is information and not knowledge. Information about the others that does not mean the possession of true understanding of the knowledge that has to come from within. From the inside, a process that can never leave us unchanged. If the aim of this exhibition was to establish a dialogue between the equals, the question that remains open could be also formulated as, what would happen to contemporary art if it was judged by other cultures following the same criteria? What would be the value of our masterpieces? The answer to this question underlines the importance of cultural values inserted into art objects, something this exhibition consciously had erased. It is clear that without exporting the symbolic value with them, the value of our masterpieces would never reach the prices assigned to them at Sotheby's, for example. The second part of our discussion should open the space for questions related to the concept of contemporary in contemporary art. In order to be able to imagine the possible future for art and artists worldwide, it might be useful to first orient ourselves, as Alain Badiou frequently reminds us. For this to happen, I believe we must have a more Althusserian approach. It is praxis that shows to which ideological paradigm we belong to, and not our proclaimed thoughts and beliefs. As we are witnessing today, the use of the term contemporary art has a blurry history. In some canons and institutions, it officially begins after 1945, in others after the 1960s or after the disappearance of art movements. There have been at least three influential attempts to discuss this issue. The well-known questioner by the magazine October in the autumn of 2009, two issues of the Iflux journal at the same time, and in Germany, the Global Art and the Museum project of Hans Belting, Andrea Budenzig, and Peter Weibel has hosted a range of seminars and publications analyzing the overlaps and antagonism between discourses of contemporary art. As it happens with the majority of the topics discussed in the art field, it seems that these events were enough of reflection. They showcase the plurality of the meaning of contemporary, hence the business continued as usual. Nevertheless, we have been reminded recently of this task by the philosopher Simon Critchley. In a recent article entitled Absolutely Too Much, he notices rightfully that contemporary art has become, quote, the central placeholder for the articulation of cultural meanings, good, bad, or indifferent. The problem with contemporary art is that we all think we know what it means and we don't. As a consequence, the discourse that surrounds it is drastically impoverished. End of quote. Hence, what does contemporary art mean today? In the past 20 years, it is possible to diagnose the expansion of two main ways in which spectacularization happened in the art world, through the biennialization on one side and the emergence of monster museums, often as signs of corporatization on the other. The system of contemporary art is also a highly speculative one, as nobody is able to predict the value of artistic production in this moment. The value will be accumulated with the passage of time through the build-up of an artist's career, the number of sold works, the number of exhibitions, etc., and various other parameters which will allow the unprecedented profit in some imaginary future. A future that will prove that betting on that horse was the right decision, the right investment. Or as Julia Bryan-Wilson notices in her reply to the October questionnaire, professors transform into prognosticators. We must predict, using our best guesses, what contemporary work we think will last for later histories. End of quote. What we fail to see in that construction of the future is that we most likely won't be there to profit from it. So the remaining question is, who will? Well, at least that is clear, the market itself. Hence, this construction contains the belief that the system will not be changed in the future, and that the same parameters to judge artistic creativity will remain as well. Therefore, we should all participate in defending the system. It must not be changed, as our art and future profit depend on it. One of the first questions that comes to mind when discussing the contemporary in the arts is what happened to modernism, as well as why has been its next stage, the postmodern, skipped in describing this art being replaced by contemporary. As Cuauhtémoc Medina states, contemporary is the term that stands to mark the death of modern. Contemporary fails to carry even a glimmer of the utopian expectation of change and possible alternatives encompassed by the new. As it seems, after the rejection of naivety of modernist belief of progress, utopias, and transformation, the contemporary is here to introduce a belief that we have already reached that future, that we live in the peak of human civilization, hence there is no need to imagine a different world. The only thing that matters is to keep on living in the present. One of the important traits of contemporary art we should always have in mind is the connection between creativity and ideological promotion. Or, as Martha Rosler has noticed it, quote, there had been a general presumption among post-war government elites and their organs, including the Ford Foundation, that nurturing creativity in whatever form was good for the national brand. Predispositions toward original research in science and technology and art, unencumbered by prescribed messages, were potent symbols of American freedom, of thought, of choice. Further troubling, artists' rather frantic dance of disengagement from the market and the ideological mechanisms throughout the 60s. End of quote. What we witness today is the positioning of contemporary art between high culture and entertainment, or as Medina has named it, intermediary region between elite entertainment and mass culture. Quote, in a compelling and scary form, modern capitalist society finally has an art that aligns with the audience, with the social elites that finance it, and with the academic industry that serves as its fellow traveler, end of quote. Having all this in mind, what happened to the artists? Simon Critchley reflects on the role of, the artists have served in the past years as a tool of promoting a particular economy through their lifestyle. Quote, the contemporary artist has become the aspirational paradigm of the new worker, creative, unconventional, flexible, nomadic, creating value and endlessly traveling. In the pose for this work paradigm, defined by immaterial labor, artists are the perfect entrepreneurs and incarnate the new bohemization of the workplace. End of quote. Also, as Rosal states, art students have by now learned to focus not on an object-centered brand signature so much as on a personality-centered one, in imitation of show business principles, we might add. Or as Critchley has termed it, we are witnessing the operations of casino capitalism, something he diagnosed to be in work in both the academia and contemporary art. Critchley goes a step further and states the different attitude between those fields toward their financiers, who seem to be more and more shady. Quote, perversely, perhaps, what I admire about much contemporary art is the negotiation of its own relentless commodification, the consciousness of its capture with the circuits of casino capitalism. To work in a university is to be aware that money is changing hands, but the money is hidden, and professors like myself can still give themselves the illusion that they are clean-handed, authentic educators and not money-laundering knowledge pimps. But artists do not have that luxury, which gives them a certain honest edginess and less chronic institutional dependency than academics. End of quote. Whatever the differences in their attitude, we might add, both fields are suffering the consequences of privatization, whose effects we have only begun to see. In the analysis of contemporary art, a question that inevitably comes to mind is, what does the new architecture of museums and institutes of contemporary art tell us? Let me. See some images. This is Guggenheim 1959, and this is new one in Bilbao, 97. The future one in plan for 2017. Yeah, this is just a random selection of some of the architectural examples. When we look at those contemporary temples, we see mesmerizing buildings that look more like spaceships that have just landed than museums we have been used to see around. And when they land in a certain territory, they bring with them not only precious art objects, but tourist crowds and consumerist desires as well. They are clean in usually dumpy neighborhoods under construction. They usually offer French cuisine on their menu, perfumed toilets, and souvenirs with images of all that critical art. What matters even more here is that the current public discussions related to the political discourse seem to have been moved into these confined spaces. Spaces where anything is allowed as long as it does not disturb the architecture of the building and as long as it stays inside, never endangering the rulers. At this point, I would like to reflect on two episodes in which I have found myself and which were related to the experience of the new architecture of contemporary art. The first one took place in the Centre Pompidou Metz, a new satellite museum opened at the eastern border of France in 2010, built at the same time when most of the factories had been closed down in this region. It is supposed to generate profit from being one of the main tourist attractions around, But this switch in the economy from production to services brings also an unpleasant feeling that the fact that people are massively staying out of work has been skillfully covered up by this seductive new institution. The second situation happened in the neighborhood of La Boca in Buenos Aires, one of the poorest neighborhoods in this city. It is also one of the main tourist spots, since its cheerfully colored houses look wonderful on photos. During our visit there, me and my two friends had an uncomfortable feeling all the time, a slight feeling of danger around us. After a short walk, we found our refuge at the recent contemporary art center created in the midst of it all. A sad conclusion that we felt finally safe and at home within its cold, air-conditioned walls, where we could further educate ourselves at an exhibition on political art in Argentina and Brazil. A process of gentrification of poor neighborhoods through art is a relatively new development, but it seems it has been successfully exported and implemented in this part of the world as well. One of the most common interpretations of the term contemporary is that it means the relationship we have not with time, but with other human beings living at the same time. As Hans-Ulrich Obrist has formulated it, it may be what is perhaps most clearly seen in its use as a noun. The word contemporary implies a relation. One is a contemporary of another. I believe that another discussion would be necessary to trace how this meaning of the term came to be. But what matters here, perhaps, is to stress a different interpretation given by Giorgio Agamben, as this might be the key to its understanding. Agamben stresses the fact that this term implies a relation to time, therefore the relation each of us has to time and not to one another. This inevitably brings out the different concepts regarding time, we might add, as different cultures imply different definitions of time as well. According to Agamben, the term that marks this relation of true contemporaries to time is, following Nietzsche, disconnection and out of jointness. Quote, those who are truly contemporary, who truly belong to their time, are those who neither perfectly coincide with it nor adjust themselves to its demands. They are, in this sense, irrelevant, inattuale. End of quote. The contemporary also keeps a distance from his own time. Or in other words, an intelligent man can despise his time while knowing that he nevertheless irrevocably belongs to it, that he cannot escape his own time. More precisely, it is that relationship with time that adheres to it through a disjunction and an anachronism. What does then the contemporary sees while looking at his time? According to Agamben, the contemporary is he who firmly holds his gaze on his own time so as to perceive not its light, but rather its darkness. The contemporary is precisely the person who knows how to see this obscurity, who is able to write by dipping his pen in the obscurity of the present. And in this engagement with the darkness of one's time, we might say, lies its political strength. Quote, the contemporary is the person who perceives the darkness of his time as something that concerns him, as something that never ceases to engage him. The contemporary is the one whose eyes are struck by the beam of darkness that comes from his own time. End of quote. What this means in relation to art is that if it wants to be called contemporary, it has to be made by the ones who do not allow themselves to be blinded by the lights of the century, who are able, through the archaeology of the present, to make us aware of what it means to be living at this time, assume the same for everyone. Contemporary artists should be able to reflect on the past as well. Quote, if as we have seen, it is the contemporary who has broken the vertebra of his time, then he also makes of this fracture a meeting place or an encounter between times and generations. End of quote. And for the beginning, one might hope that there will be a different art possible as well, art that will not be made for the blinding lights of those fake spaceships who are placed there only to confuse us, to disorient us, linking the progress and future to capitalism itself. As we have seen, the prevailing interpretation of the term contemporary is to convince us that we have reached this utopian moment when all the people of this planet are interconnected, that globalization brought us awareness of the butterfly effect, while what is really brought is the awareness that, unfortunately, we all have different experiences of contemporaneity. We live under different circumstances, and the facts show only that the codependency of rich minority from the poor majority has never been bigger. Perhaps the Russian version of the term «современное искусство», meaning contemporary experience, makes this much clearer. This is a term used to name contemporary art. Defining the art world as a space in which to reflect on the experience of contemporaneity and not a space for the production of fetishized subjects and objects. As Johannes Fabian has shown us, one of the main achievements of the colonial discourse was to make it possible to share the same physical space with the colonized ones while locating them into different time zones. A fact we should always keep in mind, not allowing to be seduced by bright lights of the contemporary. As a conclusion, we might hope at this point that the same paralysis that haunts anthropology from the beginning of globalization soon catches the art world as well. That's it.